this morning, Chinesky versus Walker.
Gibson, my family and I are here today on behalf of Governor Walker and his former press agent, Colin Wierwe. Just to touch base on jurisdiction, this case already went through jurisdictional briefing, and because the district court's second ruling on the motion to dismiss was premised on waiver, this court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal under the Hernandez case. Now let's move to waiver. On the equal protection claim, keeping in mind we've got two claims, there's no arguable basis to defend the district court's waiver ruling on that claim. It was first put into the amended complaint, and we immediately moved to dismiss based on qualified immunity. Now, when we get to the privacy claim, the starting point we have to look at is the filing of the amended complaint, because that complaint replaced the original pleading, and we responded to it. Once advised that Chesensky was planning on making some kind of privacy claim, we asserted the defense both in our answer and in the process of briefing the motion to dismiss.
Where do we see a privacy claim in the amended complaint?
Well, that's what we're struggling with, Your Honor. We didn't see it. And so we concluded that Chesensky wasn't pursuing that claim.
Where did that surface? Was it in the briefing on the original motion to dismiss?
Exactly. And it surfaced in briefing not just as kind of a legal argument, but also as an actual factual assertion, saying, you know, I was required to do this very invasive background check, and I'm even going to give you evidence to show that I had to do this. And that's really what the district court was looking at when the district court said, okay, I guess it states a claim. So when she amended her complaint, changed her claims, and didn't import that factual assertion now into a pleading where it belonged, we concluded that she had decided not to pursue it.
So, I mean, the second pleading vacated the first plea. In other words, all we have in the pleadings is what the Second Amendment complaint would be.
Exactly.
Was there any question about whether there should be a qualified immunity assertion earlier in the game, in the initial pleading?
No, Your Honor. I mean, first of all, qualified immunity can be asserted at various points in the pleading. But
I know
certainly
that, but I sort of get the impression from Judge Randa that why'd you wait around?
Right. I think what Judge Randa held that we should have asserted qualified immunity in response to the original complaint. But that violates the rule that an amended complaint replaces the pleading and defendants are required and entitled to plead anew.
So you're saying it doesn't matter because once the equal protection claim.
Right. And I think what Judge Randa may have been kind of intuitively responding to, which is that this case has been around a while, longer than you would expect a case to be at this phase. But 9 months of that were taken up by the United States as they decided whether they wanted to intervene, and then there was a motion for rehearing all on this issue of the 11th Amendment and whether there's a claim under 11 U.S.C. 525A.
And then so that was dropped when they, I guess, changed because it was a statutory thing as opposed to constitutional.
Exactly. And, I mean, it had been a long time. He's busy. And then this waiver ruling was made in the context of we did the jurisdictional briefing, and then this court asked Judge Randa, please explain the basis for your dismissal of your rejection of their motion to dismiss. And he made this ruling very quickly. So, I mean, obviously, there's just not a lot in the ruling, but it's clear that finding waiver based on our failure to raise qualified immunity regarding the original complaint can't be correct. And that's why Chesensky, in her brief, moves to a kind of a different basis.
What we have is a Second Amendment complaint with a qualified immunity defense.
Right. It's actually their First Amendment complaint. They had a complaint, and then they amended it. Right. So Chesensky's theory is, well, you should have, once the amended complaint was filed, you should have raised it more quickly. As I said before, we thought she wasn't raising a privacy claim. We still don't see it in the pleading today. And waiver has to be knowing. So if the pleading doesn't tell the defendants that the claim is there, they can't have waived the defense. And I think it's important to note that Chesensky has had an opportunity to brief the issues that are, you know, relevant to the qualified immunity claim. Obviously, she's even gotten a ruling on it. So there's no prejudice to her in her opportunity to rebut the defense.
Factually, by Wisconsin law, how does the appointment go? Is there a recommendation by the by a party, or by are the names submitted to the governor to consider, or is the governor free to choose anyone in Wisconsin that he wants to?
The governor is free to choose whomever in Wisconsin he wants to. So people apply. I think there were 10 applicants here.
No, nothing prior to that. There's a vacancy. He can pick anybody and fill it.
Exactly. For that interim period until the next regularly scheduled election.
Well, as I understand it, when I don't know how this bankruptcy issue came up. Obviously, bankruptcy, when it's usually in the paper, it's not a secret. But apparently the governor wasn't aware of it, and then when he was aware of it, that's when he changed his mind on the appointment. Is that correct?
Well, that's what the complaint alleges.
Yeah, I know. I don't know, you know, not the issue of privacy notwithstanding. That's when the change came about. Now,
right.
She was then and is now the chief deputy, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Right, she is the deputy register of deeds now.
And the person who was appointed otherwise apparently was reelected or elected.
Yes, she was. Mm-hmm. In November 2012, the appointed person was elected. So I wanted to make a couple of points on the merits of the qualified immunity defense on the privacy claim. And I want to talk both about the Denius type claim, which is what we thought she was pursuing, and then also a kind of new sort of defamation type claim that they describe in their brief. So basically, under the Denius case, somebody bringing a privacy claim needs to have basically three elements. They need to have a plaintiff who objected to the disclosure of very private information about him or herself. You need to have a government with a way of compelling that information from the person. And third, we need to know exactly what kind of information we're talking about. The fact that a person had, you know, collection actions pending against them or that they had filed bankruptcy, that's not the kind of highly private information that would be protected under a due process theory.
Well, where are we with the privacy claim? What's the record show? Are you asking us to rule on privacy at this point?
It's
only limited to these First Amendment complaint.
What we're asking this court to hold is to reverse the district court's waiver ruling and then to hold that this complaint fails to overcome qualified immunity because it fails to make out a constitutional violation based on a privacy theory.
Well, how does that come under equal protection?
Well, there are two different claims. One is, privacy and equal protection is separate
claims. We're still dealing with privacy at this stage.
Well, no, both claims are at issue in this appeal.
Okay. Well, the reason I just want to know how much is in the record on that. Is there enough in the record to look and see? Those of us who have been through political wards know there's not a lot of privacy when you are running for public office or something else that's high profile.
Right.
Don't know. Is this just sort of an obscure office nobody pays any attention to? Or?
Right. Well,
when you run for this is a statewide election, isn't it?
No. This is each county has its own registered deeds, it's a county wide.
I understand, but it's
it is an election.
It's a general election.
Right. So the November 2012 election was contested, and there were two candidates, and it's also a partisan election, so there's a Republican and a Democrat.
But is that when those kinds of issues get raised, or is? That's what I want to know, what's in the record. Is there some
So this was a motion to dismiss, a 12B6 type setting, so we're just looking at the complaint. And all Chesensky gives us is paragraph 19 of her amended complaint. And all paragraph 19 says is that unlike Chesensky, the eventual appointee didn't have to do a background check. That's all we've got. We don't know that Chesensky objected to this background check. We don't know what invasive things she was required to disclose. We don't know anything. And that's really important because this is just standard background check stuff. So we're still standing here wondering what this is all about. And the letter, the case law is clear that if you don't object, that's fatal to a privacy claim. And if we don't know what kind of information is at issue, that too is fatal to a privacy claim. And I just wanted to comment briefly on this new kind of privacy claim she brings up in her brief. It's not based on the idea of forced disclosure. It's based on the idea of broadcasting information. And as an initial matter, the pleading doesn't even allege that anything specific about her was disclosed. It said they engaged in derogatory comments and innuendo, but that's not a basis for a privacy claim.
Well, politics can be pretty rough. And when you say, well, I was going to appoint somebody, as is alleged here, and then we did a background check, and I changed my mind, if that's what happened here. I'm not really going to explain what the information was. That raises far more questions than it answers.
I agree it's a painful process, but the question before this court is whether it states a basis for a due process privacy claim, and it doesn't. This court held in Wolf. I'm sorry.
No, I didn't say.
Oh. As this court held in Wolf, the U.S. Supreme Court has never held that the disclosure of private information violates due process. And so a claim that the appellants caused Ms. Chesensky embarrassment or reputational harm wouldn't be a basis for a privacy claim.
Ms. Gibson, I gather from your briefing, the governor's entitled to consider political affiliation in making this appointment?
Yes.
Electability?
Yes.
Fundraising ability, the
sure.
ability to help other people on the ticket. Can the governor consider race?
We would like to stay away from that issue. It's not presented in this case, and we think there would be a whole different set of kind of potentially.
Really? It's not presented, concerns. But I would think that the logic of your position clearly points you in that direction. We have a long history of political efforts to balance tickets by race, by gender, by geography, by religion. Do you see anything unconstitutional about that?
No, and I think, you know, one thing that the court can do in this instance is kind of limit its analysis to the question of an interim appointment to an elected office, because there's a built-in correction, and we know, to the extent we're tempted to say, well, the 14th Amendment needs to get involved in some wild circumstances, say a governor, we're just going to exclude every person of color from any political appointment. We don't need to go there because we're in this narrow range where the political system has a built-in correction.
Well, I understand your logic, in essence. As everybody in the room knows, we have this extensive body of 14th Amendment jurisprudence that has grown up around public employment. I'm not aware of it ever being applied to elective office. And I understand your brief to be describing, in essence, a huge constitutional chasm between the status of people who hold elective office, whether they're elected or appointed, and everybody else. Is that right?
That's right.
Just, again, another factual matter. Each county's clerk's office stands alone. There's no statewide organization it's an elective office for that county.
Right. There's no governmental body that links them all together. They have an association that's very active.
What about the employees in the clerk's office? Are they merit employees, or are they civil service employees, or are they at will?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't know that these are county employees. The statutes describe the Register of Deeds as being entitled to appoint a deputy, but it seems likely they would have some civil service protection once.
Well, none of them have been elected.
No, those are not elected people.
So there may be some, I don't know, sometimes there's civil service, sometimes you have other reasons you can't just fire somebody at will.
But that's not part of this case. She still has her job, first of all, but even if something had happened.
She is a deputy clerk, but I just wonder how that came about. I'll ask the other side, too.
Right. And to the extent she were having problems at the county level with her employment in some way, that's not controlled by any kind of state officials because those employees are county officials.
And this is till the next general election? Is that how it works,
her
appointment?
Right. So that appointment would have lasted until November 2012, and then she could have run. And now the office is held by an elected official.
I suppose she could have run anyway.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. Okay, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right now, thank you. Mr. Albert?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Because of the quick nature of the appellant's argument regarding jurisdiction, I'd like to start with that subject and then try to respond carefully to many of the points that were raised, because I have a concern with regard to the accuracy of what has gone on so far in the procedural background of this case. So with respect to jurisdiction, first of all, plaintiff's privacy claim was asserted in the initial pleading in several paragraphs in the complaint. It was repeated verbatim.
Where do we find that in the original complaint?
Paragraphs 14 to 17 and 19 to 21. Now, the district court had no difficulty in discerning the nature of the claim because the district court has upheld the privacy claim twice. In the court's initial decision on the motion to dismiss, while the court did not agree.
14 to 17 looks a lot like.
In the amended complaint.
It looks a lot like defamation, in essence.
Right.
And you know, you get into the Paul versus Davis, and is there a liberty interest, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, when you describe your claims, you don't identify a privacy claim. I'm not sure how the district judge discerned a privacy claim here. He was kind to you.
Well, may I explain?
Sure.
Because in our brief, there was a motion to dismiss mm-hmm. that was brought. And so in the motion to dismiss brief that we filed, we labeled in our argument three sections with regard to privacy. One regarding liberty in employment, two mm-hmm. regarding due process in employment, and three was captioned privacy. Mm-hmm. And we briefed it in the mm-hmm. very first brief submitted in this case, which has been part of the record throughout. There has been no change with regard to the understanding that the district court has had from the very beginning with regard to our privacy claim. It was point blank set out in the very first brief.
Why not identify it in your amended complaint?
Well, because it was the concept of substantive due process involving the First and the 14th Amendment. Due process is derived alternatively from both of those amendments. But, yes, we did not use the word privacy, but at that point when we filed the amended complaint, to keep it straightforward and simple because of the incredible complexity heretofore in the case, we simply reiterated what was in the original complaint, which the judge clearly understood, was very clearly laid out in our brief, and I have absolutely no explanation for why the defendants have continued to, quite frankly, misrepresent the nature of the claims throughout these proceedings.
Mr. Albrecht, that's a pretty strong accusation for somebody who doesn't even use the word privacy in either of the complaints.
But the first of all, pleadings are notice pleading to put the other side.
Sure.
Sure. And so in our brief.
But this ambiguity is. Our court is often willing to save people from their own vagueness and ambiguity. I frankly am troubled when ambiguity is used as a weapon. And that's what this looks like to
me.
Well,
and I appreciate that. I respect that. And I'm very loath to make more of what I have just said. But it is true that if you read our original brief in opposition to dismiss the original complaint,
I've read it.
It is crystal clear laid out, the nature of the privacy claim. There's no way of misunderstanding it. It's very
and
clear.
And then it's not clarified in the amended complaint.
But no, it is okay. The amended complaint. But it's the same language.
With respect to jurisdiction, which is where you started, you would agree we have jurisdiction over the appeal from the denial of qualified immunity as to the equal protection claim against Governor Walker, correct?
That's correct, Judge Hamilton.
All right. And then with respect to privacy, the privacy claims in whatever vague way they exist, I understand your position that that the qualified immunity defense was not correctly raised in the district court, correct?
Correct.
But it was raised, and the district judge denied it. Why isn't that enough to give us jurisdiction?
It's not because it was not properly raised. You cannot raise a defense or an argument only in a reply brief. There have been two motions to dismiss filed. Qualified immunity with regard to the privacy claims was not raised in either motion. It was not raised in all of the briefings.
Well, I understand waiver. I also know judges often excuse waiver. But I don't understand how your argument about raising it too late defeats jurisdiction on appeal.
Because we had no opportunity to respond to it. The first time qualified immunity and privacy were put together was in a reply brief. That's why I believe, in part, Judge Randa ruled that enough with the dilatory tactics, and he denied the motion. Judge Randa is in a much better position, the best position, to assess the proceedings that have taken place before him. And he has the inherent power to referee the course of litigation before him. And he has sat through all of the motion practice that has precluded any discovery in this case for 2 years. It's all been motion practice. And he was well within his discretion, as we've cited several cases to support, he had the right to decide that the motion for qualified immunity at this stage has been waived. That does not mean that there could not be a revisiting of qualified immunity, for example, at summary judgment, where it often is raised. But we have not yet begun discovery in this case.
Mr. Albrecht, if we were to decide qualified immunity based on the first step of the analysis, that is, whether there's an allegation that states a claim under the Constitution in your privacy claims, what prejudice would there be to you, since you have had an opportunity to address those merits in the original motion to dismiss?
The issue as to whether there is a claim or not, I would agree to the extent that we do acknowledge and that there was a motion to dismiss filed under 12b-6, which is why we did take it upon ourselves to at least set up the parameters of the claim that's been asserted in the complaint to show that there is a claim that is not frivolous, because this court would have the power to make a determination under a 12b-6 motion as to whether a claim has been stated. That, however, cannot bootstrap a qualified immunity defense, which encompasses the well-settled and other considerations that go into the decision on a motion to dismiss. All we have to do on a motion to dismiss under the pleading standards is assert a colorable claim.
You have to state a claim for relief.
We do.
Under the Constitution.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we have.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit.
What is that claim?
Yeah.
Well, under the right to privacy claim, it's been clearly established in the Seventh Circuit since the Denius case that the claim of privacy extends to certain types of private information. In Denius, it was acknowledged that there was a pre-existing right of privacy with regard to medical-related information. Denius expanded that to encompass other types of confidential information, and it addressed specifically financial information.
And now, it was addressed in the context of an employee who was commanded to provide a waiver of that information if he wanted to keep his job. How does any of that extend to somebody who wants an elective office?
Very precisely it does, Your Honor, because in order to apply for the Register of Deeds position, which, by the way, we assert is employment.
Are you serious? Employment when it's a constitutional office that's elective?
The day after the appointment, is she not an employee of the county? She is.
She's a public officer.
Well, but she's also
of
an
course she gets a W-2, but that's
correct.
Not. But if you're distinguishing between public office and employment, and that's a long tradition of that in American law, there's a huge gap between elective office and being a subordinate employee.
Well, there's a huge gap in certain respects, but in many other areas of the law, there is not. For example, Title VII, employment discrimination, also encompasses the rights of governmental employees.
But not elected officials and their staffs.
Well, you can bring claims against them. But to your point.
You're talking about it being a plaintiff, though.
Yes. Yes.
Now, you're familiar with the definition of employee in Title VII.
I am.
All right. Mm-hmm.
But let me return to your prior question about mm-hmm. Denius and the question of the compulsion. We were discussing whether there's a distinction between an employee and a potential appointee. One of the arguments that the state has raised is that she voluntarily agreed to this. Now, Denius does discuss the coercion aspect, which is a big part of their argument. In order to continue with employment, the employee was required to sign a release. In our case, in order to apply for the position, Ms. Chizinski was forced to sign a blanket release to obtain information which resulted in an investigation which did not take place for the person who was ultimately appointed.
How would your privacy reasoning apply to, since as I understand it, this, how would this apply to, let's say, the White House counsel's office asking somebody interested in being appointed as a federal judge to provide personal, financial, and other information, or to the Senate Judiciary Committee, or to their equivalents at the state level?
Well, no disrespect to our Registrar of Deeds, but the inherent governmental interest involved with appointing an Article III federal judge, the interest in
the
information.
Tell me, where would you draw the boundary? We have a constitutional office that's dedicated by Wisconsin's fundamental law to say the people have a right to make a choice about this, for better or worse.
Right.
Where would you draw the line?
We draw the line with respect to evaluating the nature of the governmental interest asserted and linking that to the conduct that took place. So, for example, in race, you asked the question of opposing counsel about race discrimination in appointment. That would be a violation of the 14th Amendment.
How about with federal judges?
That I think it would be as well.
You think it's a violation of the equal protection aspect of the Fifth Amendment for a president or a senator to consider race in judicial appointments?
I think it can be, depending, among other factors. Ex parte Virginia clearly held in 1879 that equal protection trumps a judge's discretion as to who to appoint to a jury. So the concept...
Juries are entirely different. We're talking here about
but it's the discretionary
public office.
Yes.
It sounds like you're trying to take the politics out of politics.
Don't we all want to do that?
Well, not necessarily. I don't think that's our job. You say you want us to balance interests between different offices. How about, let's stick with Article 6, Section 4 of the Constitution. How about if the governor is filling a vacancy in the office of district attorney?
We have that precise case arising out of the state of Illinois. The state has an interest, if someone is to be appointed for the district attorney, in ensuring, for example, that they're not subject of a criminal mm-hmm. prosecution or that they're before a grand jury, because the state's interest is elevated. What state interest supports discriminating against a potential appointee on the basis of bankruptcy when the Congress of the United States has declared it as a matter of national law that discrimination against bankruptcy and employment is illegal?
That has to be published, doesn't it?
Pardon?
The issue of privacy and the bankruptcy.
Yes.
I'm only guessing, but I think when somebody files for bankruptcy or gets bankruptcy or declared bankruptcy, it's published.
Well, it is a court record, but the privacy concept extends to the types of information that both the person has an interest in preventing from being broadcast across the state, and also information which, although it might be public, you would really have to dig for it.
Well, not really. I mean, this is what bothers me about this whole thing about bankruptcy. Sure, nobody wants to advertise it, but it's just a fact.
It is
a
fact.
It's a fact that, as I understand it, the governor was not aware of, and then he was made aware of it. And change his mind. Now, you may think, well, that's not fair. Well, believe me, if she had run for a contested office and she had bankruptcy, somebody would have brought it up, like the other side. Not because it's not mean, it's not this or that and the other thing. Sure, if they got something like that, they'll bring it up. That's not that's politics. And unfortunately, when you engage in politics, you better look out.
But correct, Judge Mannion, but the state interest is to appoint someone, the best qualified candidate,
always,
to fulfill the position, which is a ministerial position. We're not talking about someone like
and
in a district of state. Pardon?
Why is it an elected
office?
Well,
the Constitution of Wisconsin provided for that way back. I can only speculate as to all the reasons. But
that's the problem.
Yeah.
What private information was published about your client?
Well, Judge Hamilton, here's the problem. We don't know. No.
What private information, you're making a kind of constitutional defamation claim here, and there shouldn't be any secrecy about what the information is that was supposedly defamatory. What is it?
First of all, we're not making a per se defamation claim, mm-hmm. but what we are saying is that when it was announced on Fox TV across the state by a press spokesman for the governor that when he learned of her bankruptcy, that was the reason she was not appointed. So that is out there. But
the
nature of the commentary, the nature of the comments, and the basis for them were set forth in the complaint when we made reference to derogatory information that demeaned her professional and personal character.
What was it?
Well, that's for discovery.
No. What was published that was defamatory? What was your phrase? Derogatory information that was impugned and harmed her professional and personal reputation. What was it?
Well, it was information that suggested that things were learned in the background check, which included a criminal background check on her. That was implied.
Implied?
Yes.
Okay, anything else? And presumably anything in the criminal background would not have been private, right?
It would have raised an additional set of issues if the information had been false.
Sure.
But as things stand today, we do not know the scope, and we do not know what precisely the credibility was for the information that was obtained. And furthermore, she had no knowledge or notice that whatever was researched would be broadcast. She never agreed to that. Counsel made reference to the fact that she didn't object. She had no opportunity to object.
What did she think she was doing when she applied to the governor of the state for appointment to an elective office?
Correct. But then why was a background investigation, criminal investigation, only performed with respect to her and not the candidate who was selected? If there was a legitimate state reason for it, then there has to be uniformity of treatment.
You think there's a difference when somebody's being appointed to what will eventually be an elected office person as opposed to the person who just declares, I'm running? I doubt that there is. I don't mean that wrong, but if you apply to run for an office, I don't know what it takes in Wisconsin. You show up and you sign, you're going to run. Sometimes you got to raise some money to be able to run. I don't know what the rules are. But as far as a full disclosure, to run for elected office, you got to come up with some kind of a disclosure?
Well, I can't answer that generally, Judge Mannion, but I can say this in response, that it is not a legitimate interest in our position that the person chosen is automatically going to run in a contested election down the road. The purpose of this quick appointment is to get a person in there to fulfill the ministerial duties. Right. The election is a separate issue.
It's a political opportunity. It's given to a political figure, the governor. Is he prohibited from considering political affiliations?
Well, perhaps he can.
Under your theory.
No, he's not absolutely prohibited. And, in fact, in this case, we've submitted in our appendix the support she received from the local Republican assembly person.
So why, under your theory, why doesn't a Democrat who says that she's better qualified have a constitutional claim against the governor?
Because we're not saying that party affiliation per se is unconstitutional. We are saying that
then electability and the political consequences clearly are legitimate interests in this appointment, then, right?
Well, we disagree on that point. We don't.
But party split the difference for me there that says political affiliation is okay, but electability is irrelevant.
If the difference maker in the split is discrimination on the basis of bankruptcy, that is per se a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, because no legitimate political interest can support discrimination on the basis of bankruptcy when it violates federal statutory law.
Then what's the legitimate interest that supports consideration of political affiliation?
I think there can be certain considerations. For example, is the person a citizen of the state of Wisconsin?
That's not
my question. Person ever vote?
My question is whether the governor can discriminate between Republicans and Democrats in making this appointment, and why.
I believe he can because there is not a personal interest that could be asserted under the Equal Protection Clause in that context.
I don't understand what you just said.
Well, what I'm saying is that you can discriminate between Republicans and Democrats because there is not an equal protection right. Being a Republican or a Democrat is not a classification,
sure,
whereas bankruptcy is.
You cited Elrod against Burns, right?
Yeah. Right.
But so the question is, why? What is there about political affiliation that makes it legitimate, but electability is not? Because I think that's what you're telling us.
Well, I wouldn't.
And electability can include a broad range of things that you might think voters shouldn't pay attention to, but
like
they're perfectly entitled to consider.
Right? Like bankruptcy.
Well, electability is an interest of the public, not of a particular political person. In fulfilling the constitutional duty to appoint a person to that office, politics is not an exclusive interest of any legitimacy. Instead, the priority is to put the best qualified person in the job. That's the governor's interest.
Even if it's a Democrat?
If he chose, he's free to appoint a Democrat. He doesn't have to, but he's free to. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you have 5 minutes. We'll give you a couple more minutes. You have 7 minutes.
You don't need to use all of them either.
I'd just like to respond to a few of Mr. Albrecht's points. First, on jurisdiction, I think he's conflating his arguments about the merits of the waiver argument, of his waiver argument, with the jurisdictional issue. Hernandez is controlling that a district court's finding of waiver is reviewable by this court. And Hernandez also says that the standard of review is de novo. Mr. Albrecht sort of alluded to an abuse of discretion standard, but that's not.
Do you agree that the governor is required to appoint the best possible candidate, or could he appoint his brother-in-law?
He could appoint his brother-in-law. I would hope he wouldn't, but under the law, he can.
He didn't.
Moving to the Dennis kind of privacy claim, the case law is clear that a plaintiff has to allege that she objected or in some other way fought back against having this disclosure, having the background check. And this complaint does not make that allegation. And that's an important issue for us on these background checks. We actually, there are lines a person can fill in and say, I don't want to provide this kind of information. So to go forward with a case on the idea that you can kind of lie in wait, see if you get the appointment, and then if you don't get it, say...
You said that there's an application form used?
Right. So especially where an applicant has an opportunity to exclude things they don't want to, it's very clear whether they've objected to or not. I mean,
Do we have that kind of detail in this record?
No, you don't. But that's why I'm using an example of why the complaint needs to tell us why there's an example. And the NASA case from the Supreme Court that we quote in our that we cite in our brief is a great example of how that works in a good for a better claim, which is the government contractors at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory were required to do this very extensive background check and move to enjoin that check so that they could keep doing their work without having to do the check. They certainly didn't just go forward with it and then a few years later come forward.
In a practical sense, in these type of cases, the governor may rely on outside contacts. In other words, he may receive calls from people in the county or in the area suggesting something. Is that anything in the record how her name surfaced?
Well, she applied for the job.
I mean, so it was just a direct application.
Right.
Unlike a party, of this person of the same party would call, say, this is a very good person, I think you ought to look at her, and so
forth. Right. The complaint doesn't say, you know, the kind of informal contacts you may have been getting, but the process was that everybody had to apply.
Well, I think that she asserts that several prominent people did recommend her, right?
Yes, that is the complaint.
What I'm perplexed about is... who first exposed the fact, and maybe you can answer it, that the fact that she had filed for bankruptcy or was bankrupt? How did that even appear?
The complaint's a little unclear. It appears that the governor's office found out on their own with no background check, and then the background check process went forward. But it wouldn't more would have been uncovered on that front.
What was exposed that the governor changed his mind because of that? How did that even come to...
Well, the complaint doesn't tell us. It almost sounds like somebody in the governor's office was just looking into people informally.
Do we know, is there in some states, for example, the state police are tasked to do background checks. Is that what happens in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, the agency I work for, the Department of Justice, the Department of Justice does background checks in Wisconsin, our Department of Criminal Investigation.
So similar, as an agency that's assigned, that's what they do if you have that background check necessary.
Right.
They're the ones that do it.
Right, and obviously we're not otherwise involved with the process in any other way other than the background check. And then I just wanted to move quickly to the kind of defamation privacy claim. And we were, you know, interested to find out what kind of information was supposedly disclosed. And I believe what I heard was, first of all, that the fact of the bankruptcy filing itself was one of the pieces of information that was disclosed. That's not the kind of highly private, confidential information that courts talk about when they are considering privacy claims. Dennius and Malleus are really specific about the narrow band of information that qualifies for this privacy protection. And then the innuendo claim, the case law is clear, and Wolf talks about this, innuendo is not a basis for a due process privacy claim. It might be some kind of common law right, but it's not a constitutional claim.
Well, as far as qualified immunity, just that issue you say is before us.
Right.
And what do we look at there? Something that's unconstitutional and clearly established?
Right.
What?
Well, we take a look at the complaint and we see whether the facts alleged in the pleading allege a violation of the Constitution based on a privacy theory. And then I don't even think we get to the clearly established because
pleading. So we can stop at the issue of a constitutional issue.
I think so. And finally, Mr. Albrecht suggested that discovery will tell us what was disclosed. But it was plaintiff's burden to come forward when she filed this lawsuit with a complaint that stated what the violation of her privacy rights were. She can't use discovery as an avenue to shop or ferret around for information that might discover.
Ms. Gibson, can I ask you, when a person volunteers to run for public office, would you agree that that makes them a public figure for constitutional purposes? We're talking about defamation and invasion of privacy claims under Time against Hill and New York Times against Sullivan.
Yes.
Do you see any difference between that status and somebody who volunteers for appointment to the same office?
No, given that the person, the appointment is an interim appointment and is still an elected office. So the Supreme Court has encouraged courts to resolve immunity issues as soon as possible, preferably before allowing discovery. And what we're asking the court to do today is to reverse the district court on both claims and hold that they are both barred by qualified immunity. That what that ruling will do is allow the parties to move forward on Chesinski's other claims in this case.
And that would be the 525 claim?
Primarily. I don't know if she wants to keep pursuing her liberty employment type claim. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. And we'll